This is Amy Boss-Tenniger from the Manhattan Church of Christ. Thank you for listening to our podcast. The sermon you are about to hear was recorded from our Sunday morning worship service. You can watch our entire worship service on our YouTube channel. Simply visit manhattanchurch.org and click on the YouTube icon. We hope that this message will be helpful to you as you explore the Word of God. And now, this week's message.
Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. Then she said, "I have produced a man with Yahweh's help." And again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Abel was keeper of flocks, and Cain worked the ground. After some time had passed, Cain brought some of the fruit of the ground as an offering to Yahweh. And Abel also brought some of the firstborn of his flock, the fat ones. And Yahweh looked with favor on Abel and on his offering, but he didn't look on Cain and his offering. This kindled fierce anger in Cain, and his face fell into a scowl. Then Yahweh said to Cain, "Why are you burning with anger, and why is your face scowling? Isn't it true that if you do good, what's good, you'll be lifted up? You'll be lifted up, but if you don't do what's good, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is against you, and you must gain authority over it." And Cain spoke to his brother Abel. Then when they were in the field, Cain rose against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Then Yahweh said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" And he replied, "I don't know. Am I my brother's protector? But he responded, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed by the ground that opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer give its strength to you. You will be tossed about and wandering in the earth." Then Cain said to Yahweh, "My guilt is a burden too great to bear. Look, you're expelling me today from the face of the ground, and from your face also I'll be hidden. I'll be tossed about and wandering in the earth. Anyone who finds me will kill me." But Yahweh said to him, "Because of that, anyone who kills Cain will suffer sevenfold vengeance." Then Yahweh put a sign on Cain, lest anyone who found him should strike him down. So Cain went out from the presence of Yahweh and lived in the land of wandering, east of Eden.
Then God spoke to Noah and said, "Come out of the ark, you, your wife, your sons, and their wives with you, all the living animals that are with you of all flesh, including birds and livestock, and every animal that moves on the earth. Bring them out with you, and they'll swarm across the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." Noah went out along with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him. Every living animal, every moving thing, every bird, and all that moves on the earth went out of the ark with their families. Noah built an altar to Yahweh. He then took some from all pure livestock and from all pure birds and brought offerings on the altar. And Yahweh perceived the soothing aroma and said in his heart, "I'll never again curse the ground because of the human, since the inclination of the human's heart is evil from youth. I'll never again strike down everything that lives as I did. While the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease."
I hope that you'll look in your bulletin and you'll find a sheet that has at the top of it, "Violence and Corruption Reign." Sounds like a good movie title, doesn't it? I just want to urge you to remember the young people that we have that are down in Nashville in the Engage program there, and that are finishing their work today and will be coming home. I hope that everything has gone just beautifully for them, and of course for safe travels and all of that as they return home. And pray especially for Cynthia and Lynette as they're returning from Haiti, that none of the kind of travel problems that they've experienced while there will hit them in the process of returning home, because they are doing such a great work there. We also, again, I want to welcome the young people who've come to us from Arkansas and are on their way on mission here. I understand some of them don't yet know where they're going, so I'm not going to tell them, because I know where they're going, but I don't want to tell them, because it's a surprise. It's a kind of mission trip, as I understand, in which they discover what they're called to participate in, and that's a wonderful thing. It's a great kind of program. And also remember, I just give a word of encouragement to those who are thinking about the young adult retreat. Go ahead and do it. Sign up and register for that. Sign up for the congregational retreat. That one I know a lot more about what's happening with it, because I'm in conversation with Julie, and she's just doing wonderful work in preparation for our congregational retreat. So I just really want to encourage everybody to do that. Now we're in the midst of a study series in which we're looking at the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And this is a sermon about sin, as the title might indicate. Not that we haven't seen some issues about sin. We started, of course, as you have mentioned before in the series, we spent the first three talking about the first three chapters, a chapter per message, basically. There's a little variation there. Chapter one about the creation of the cosmos and so forth. Chapter two, the creation of the human being and all that's involved in that. The human being, the animals, the male and female coming as the human is divided and so forth, knowing good and evil. It comes up then in the third chapter as we see that as the crisis of their service to God. And they end up in exile from the garden and the temptation and all of that. But it's one of the interesting things that, as we noted when we were talking about that third chapter, that in common parlance, it's usually called the story of the fall. But the word fall does not occur there. It's thought of as the first sin, of course, but the word sin does not occur there in the third chapter about being in the Garden of Eden. And everybody knows that the snake is the devil, but the chapter never says that, never hints it. In fact, it says that it's a wild creature, that very clever wild creature that Yahweh God had made. And so these narratives, and it continues really all through the first 11 chapters, are narratives that are, in many ways, as we've talked about, like parables, that help us to look at certain elements about human existence in relationship to God and take things that we can all recognize, but take them in a little bit of a different, strange way, and often with unexpected elements in them, like all of a sudden there's a conversation between the woman and the snake in the garden without telling us that the snake is anything but a snake. And so we recognize in that we're dealing with a kind of reality that's different from the ordinary reality that we deal with. But we're all intelligent. We can understand the narrative and the story. And through the way in which it's done, and these narratives are so carefully told. I can't emphasize that enough. There is not a single word that is not intentional, that is out of place. And you cannot read them too carefully in all of it. And they teach us how to think, or a way to think. They challenge our thinking about who we are as human beings, what the world is like, what the challenges of thinking about our own moral choices are, and all of that. And so as we come sort of off the edge of those famous first three chapters, creation, the first creation story, the creation of the human beings in chapter 2, beginning with verse 4, and then the story of the garden and the temptation in the garden and all of that, We come to chapter 4, and it carries on some of that, but now that word that we've been anticipating, thinking about, that we've been wanting to talk about, but the text has been reticent to say it, comes to the fore. And that's the word sin. Sin emerges in full force. Murder emerges in full force. Not only murder, fratricide, murder of brother against brother. And it's for religious reasons, and it's breaking apart family. I mean, it is truly sin. And so we see all of that. But that begins as you read on through, and as I've said in the past, in this particular message, we're going to take a big block. We're going to focus on chapter 4 and another passage from chapter 8, but it's sort of trying to get a view of this big section of chapters 1 through 11 that runs from 4 through 9, really. And that sets up the preparation for the great change that happens when God calls Abraham. All through these first 11 chapters, the viewpoint is always of God with all of humanity, of the whole world. And that's the understanding that's there all the way through the Bible. Yahweh, the God of Israel, is not just Israel's God. He is the God, the only God, the Creator. And therefore, if He's the Creator, as Paul pointed out, as is pointed out by many, especially by Isaiah, if He's the Creator, He is the God not just of Israel, but of the whole world. And so as the Israelites went through so much, and as they thought of themselves as the people of God, they were the only worshipers of Yahweh. They had the temple of Yahweh. They were the ones that kept the temple going and all of that, and had the prophets and had the priests and all of it. But things just totally fell apart for them, morally, religiously. They end up with the northern 10 tribes being swept away into the Assyrian Empire, destroyed for their idolatry and their injustice and immorality. And then the southern tribes think that they've got it together, but it doesn't hold. Even though they do have some reformers and some good leaders, still it ends up with them going into exile. And it's in that time that the people realized that they had been approaching their whole faith wrong, that they really had to take this thing seriously. And they put down in writing these long-standing traditions that they had had. And you start having references to these narratives, to the narrative of creation and so forth, from that time on. And so it becomes something that helps them to understand where God's going. Why have things gone so amok for us? Why are we in exile? Is there any hope? And the story, of course, of the garden is a story of exile from the garden. And as you've read the story of Cain, we read it here this morning, as Melanie read it, it's exile from the ground. And we're going to see a lot more as we go along. And there is exile. But the reading that we did right at the beginning of the service, the call to worship, that from Revelation 22 is the coming back of everybody from exile. It's the vision of God having all His people. And ultimately, as it goes on in Revelation, you see this fantastic vision of a great city with its gates wide open and the nations flowing through, purified, healed, and the river of the water of life and the tree of life on both sides. Back to the garden, a garden that's now a city, but a garden nevertheless. And we see that there's a trajectory in all of this. And we're challenged to see, to read the narratives, to see where it goes. And I hope you'll follow me with me. I'm sure you sort of follow it with me along here, but interact with the text especially. Think about what's there in the text. That's what, not my interpretation of it, but look at the text themselves, because those are the things that are there that live. And you know, if I say something that's not there in the text, then, you know, take it with a tablespoon of salt. But for me at least, I want to listen just as carefully as I can to the text and how it gives me, like Jesus telling the parable of the prodigal son, how it gives me a vision of human life and of God and of sin. And so as we look at this story, and it's the story of Cain and Abel, the story itself of the problem comes up in just a very few verses. Right at the very beginning, you'll see in the text that you have on your sheet, you'll see that I have a lot of parentheses there in that first paragraph, because it's kind of highlighting some of the plays on words that you have. Adam and Eve, we know the word Adam means human being. So his name is human, if it were in English. And Eve's name, it's not Eve, in Hebrew it's Chava. Don't like that name very much. Chava is the name, though. Greek changes over to Ewan, from which we get Eve. But it really means life. So you have that first couple, human and life. And the human, knows life. But that knowing life produces life. She conceives and gives birth to a son. Actually, birth to two sons pretty quickly. One's name is Cain, or in Hebrew, Cain, as I've put there in the parentheses. And that's a wonderful little word. It's got three different kinds of levels. It on one level, it means spears, so that's okay. And the one that I'd really like, and the one that comes up later on in the narrative of these chapters, is the meaning smith. So this is the first smith. Smith comes in pretty quickly here. Smith in the sense of a blacksmith or a goldsmith or a metal worker and so forth. And we have some other names, Tubal-Cain and others that are come in later on that are smiths of various kinds of things in the narrative. So the first son is named Smith. But it also sounds like the word kana, and that means to produce, and Chava, or life, or Eve, says, I have produced a man with Yahweh's help. And then she gives birth to his brother. His brother's name is Hevel. And Hevel means vapor, fog. Smith, the worker of metal, and fog, vapor. It's the same word that is used in Ecclesiastes when he says, vapor, vapor, everything is vapor. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And so these two names that, well, they go along with sort of the story as it unfolds, because Hevel, that comes into our language as Abel, is the one that gets killed and vanishes from the story. Except he's brought up, of course, later on in Hebrews and never referred to again in the Old Testament, but except in this story. But Abel is keeper of a flock, and Cain isn't a blacksmith, but he's a worker of the ground. He's a farmer like his father. After some time had passed, this is verse 3 on your sheet. Cain brought some of the fruit of the ground as an offering to Yahweh. And Abel also brought some of the firstborn of his flock, the fat ones. And Yahweh looked with favor on Abel and on his offering. But he didn't look on Cain and his offering. This very kind of hyper-literalistic translation. And right from the start, we sense But it's hard to define. There's the problem here. We have all kinds of questions. Remember, as I said, and I emphasize it, this story is told exactly as it's supposed to be told. It's not leaving anything out. It's not adding anything. Every word is intended, and every omission is intended. What's omitted? Well, just about everything I want to know. Why do they think they need to bring offerings, for example? God hasn't said anything about bringing any offerings. Not a word. Why does one bring, well, I can sort of understand it. Why does one bring stuff that is from the farm? That's grain that he's raised. Cain does that. And Abel brings from his flocks. That makes sense. But does God like, you know, sacrificed lambs more than he does sacrificed grain? Well, maybe so. Certainly there's there's kind of imagery of the lamb being sacrificed that becomes very important much, much later on. But God asks for both kinds of sacrifices in the Old Testament. Why do they bring it? What does God, have they been told something that they're supposed to do? Nothing is said of it. Abel brings firstborn of his flock, fat ones. Cain brings the fruit of the ground. And then this statement that I've tried to translate quite literally, but actually all that it says is, Yahweh looked on Abel and his offering, and he did not look on Cain and his offering. Just for English, you almost have to put something in there, so I put in with favor. He looked with favor. Why did he look with favor on Abel's offering and not Cain's offering? It would have been so easy to say something, but Cain was proud when he brought it. Or that Abel was more devout in his piety when he brought it. Or something. But it doesn't. It just says Yahweh looked with favor on Abel and on his offering, but he didn't look on Cain and his offering. And it doesn't tell us even how they knew about that. Did God sort of give a report on the offering? Or did he just bless Abel and thus they thought that Abel got the better end of the bargain with God? It doesn't say. It doesn't say. We want an explanation. We want to know why. Was God just being arbitrary in this? He decided that he just flipped the coin, so to speak, or eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and he picked Abel and decided not to go with Cain? Well, there is a certainly a strong tendency all the way through Genesis and even beyond that for God to favor the younger of two siblings. You know, Jacob and Esau, he picks Jacob and so forth. Not Reuben, but Judah and Joseph are the great ones of the tribes. And it's not David's older brothers, it's little young David. He picks the younger, that so there's a kind of element of that, and that may be there, but nothing is said about that here. It's not that he favors the younger. It's just that he looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but he didn't look on Cain and his offering. And we are like Cain. We want to know why. We're like Job. Job doesn't get to listen to the first two chapters of the book of Job with the dialogues between God and Satan. He just gets slammed with all kinds of loss and suffering, and he doesn't know why. And his friends come up, and they've got all kinds of explanations for why he's suffering as he does. But God never explains to Job why he's suffering. Humans want to know why. But it's interesting that here in this very first narrative about sin, there is this element of, is God being unfair? Unfair to me. It's not unfair to other people. That's fine. Now, you know, what is, but he's unfair to me. Cain burns with anger, this kindled fierce anger in Cain, and his face fell into a scowl. God, sometimes it takes the form, and it sounds like maybe Cain had this. I thought I had a bargain with God. If I brought my offering, God would look at it and bless it. He blessed Abel's. How is his so much better than mine? And so often we feel that in ourselves. We kind of have a bargain with God that if we do good, if we do this, if we make the offering, if we do the other thing, then God's going to come through. He's going to pay off. And even at a distance, when you start reading the commentaries, the commentators, there's just all kinds of theories about, was God being arbitrary? And some really want to hammer that home. Did God have a reason for it? And some want to hammer that home. But the thing about the narrative as it's given to us is it doesn't give us either one. God may have had very, very, very good reasons for choosing one. He has the right to be arbitrary if he wants to look at one and not the other, just like Jacob and Esau, when they have not yet been born. And he comes to Cain, and he interacts with him. Verse 5, Yahweh said to Cain, why are you burning with anger? And why is your face scowling? And the next thing he said, he should say, isn't it? Is there was a very good reason why I did what I did. Let me explain it to you. I did it because this and this and this that you'd done, and that and that and that that Abel had done. And so I made a judgment that really I needed to favor Abel over against you. Does God say that? No. God doesn't say anything. He doesn't explain anything. There's something there that is the condition of the human being that we often do not know. We often don't know why we're in the situation of Job. How many funerals are there in which something disastrous has happened to somebody? And people want to figure out why it is that this has happened to a child. Why did the people in the back end of the airplane survive and those in the front die? God loved the ones in the back better than the ones in the front. Why did this child die? God wanted another angel for his heaven. We want an explanation. We want something given to us. But God does not do it. And when he comes to Cain, he simply talks to him and he says, Why are you angry, burning with anger? Why is your face scowling? We can feel it in ourselves. It's unfairness to us. But all God does is says, look, the future is ahead of you. Isn't it true that if you do what's good, you'll be lifted up? Doesn't actually say, I'll lift you up. Yes, you'll be lifted up. But if you don't do what's good, and here is that amazing line, if you don't do what's good, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is against you. Contrary to you, it wants you. And you must gain, you shall gain authority over it. You shall rule over it. What's happened has happened. You cannot change the fact that God looked at one and didn't look at the other. That's already reality. What is before you, though, is the future. And there you can do something. There you shape the future. You shape who you are. You show who you are by what you do. If you do what's good, you show who you are as good. If you don't do what's good, and here's where the word sin comes in. Notice that the word sin does not come in about the sacrifices that they brought. It's not that he had sinned in not bringing the right sacrifice. It's not even that he had sinned in scowling or even in being angry. It's that his anger, his sense of unfairness to himself and the anger about that, his desire to know and demand to know and feeling that he's lost the bargain or whatever it was, whatever combination of things one imagines within the story, whatever it is, that's the opening for sin. Sin is crouching like an animal. Crouching sort of doesn't tell us what animal it is, but you think about lions and tigers and bears, oh my. You think about things that are dangerous, that are crouching at the door. Its desire is against you. And you, I translated it must, but it's actually you shall, in the sense of the possibility is real. You can do this. You can rule over it. But it's a real conflict. And the more you are thinking of yourself and your own sense of injustice about it, the more you are vulnerable to that sin. Interesting, interesting, interesting. Paul, later on in Romans, when he's talking about sin, I've included a verse here, a couple of verses from Romans 7, 7 through 11 on the second side of your sheet, also personifies sin. Sin gets in there. It's a power. It's a living thing. Sin comes alive when I open the door to it. And so in this very first use of the word sin in the Bible, it has that sense of a living power that's threatening, but a power that is not unstoppable. Even Cain could gain authority over it, God says. But then the narrative, as it goes on, does not tell us that what Cain said to God, how he responded. It just lets us watch. Cain spoke to his brother Abel. Doesn't tell us what he said. Though some of the later, sort of the later versions, the Septuagint Greek translation says, he said to him, let's go out into the field. Maybe that's, we should, but the Hebrew just lets us see what happens. They went out, and when they were in the field, they somehow got out in the field, and we see what happens. Cain rose against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Sin has pounced, attacked, whatever verb you want to put in there. The person, the human, has opened himself up to this breaking of the relationship between himself and his brother, this murder. And then the murder that kills his brother, destroys, for all we're told in Genesis, there are only there are four of them on the face of the earth at this time, four human beings. So one-fourth of the human population. And destroyed the relationship that there should be between them. But then it's given its edge when God comes to him and says, where's your brother? And he says, I don't know. Am I my brother's protector? Greatest question ever. Am I my brother's keeper? An adult, let him take care of himself. Why are you looking at me for? Yes, you are. But not only are you your brother's protector, your brother's keeper, you are also the one to value his being, his life. You're also the one to value the whole place that he lives, the ground that he lives on. He's connected to the whole creation, and you have polluted the whole creation. And so God cries out, says to Cain, "The voice of your brother is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground." The curse is coming from the ground that opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. From now on, when you work the ground, it won't give you its strength. You'll be tossed about and wandering in the earth. And rightly so. Right? He's not getting as much as he deserves. If God said, if you eat the fruit of this tree, you're going to die, surely he's going to say, if you kill your brother, you're going to die. Right? It's only right. God should strike him down right this instant. But remember Matthew's communion meditation. You'll be tossed and wandering in the earth. Cain said to Yahweh, "My guilt is a burden too great to bear. You're expelling me today from the face of the ground, and from your face I'll be hidden. I'll be tossed about and wandering in the earth." In other words, it's like what we saw when Adam and Eve eat the fruit and they don't die that day. They keep on living for 900 and something years. Here, it is not so much physical death that is the threat, it's alienation and exile, that he's exiled from the ground and exiled from God, tossed about and wandering. But Yahweh says, those are real threats. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to strike you down and kill you. I'm not even going to forsake you as you go out wandering in the earth for what you've done. You deserve everything you get, he might have said, but he doesn't. What he says, I'm going to put a sign on you that stops anybody from punishing you for murder. Whoo! That's about as unexpected as one could find in a narrative like this. Now, who the people are that were going to do this, we're not told. It's like a lot of other things in these narratives. Because of that, anyone who kills Cain will suffer sevenfold vengeance. Then Yahweh put a sign on Cain, lest anyone who found him should strike him down. So Cain went out from the presence of Yahweh. Can you actually get beyond the presence of Yahweh? He thought he was. He felt he was. But since God is everywhere, it's a little hard to do. And Yahweh's presence was always there in that sign that was protecting him. Is that the way you would write a story about sin? Wouldn't you want to be a lot harder on it? Wandering the earth. How is that so bad? Oh, get to travel. And he lives in the land of wandering. But it's the exile from who he really is, from knowing that he could have expressed who he is by doing something good. He chose to become controlled by his anger, by his sense of unfairness to himself, by his jealousy of his brother, or whatever the motivations were. And he allowed himself to be destroyed. He lost himself in the wandering. And only God keeps him alive. Well, got to hurry here. Think about that story. The big story in the middle of all of Genesis 1 through 11, the one that takes up the most chapters, is the story of the flood. And all of us have, if you've gone to church, you know the story of the flood and Noah and the flood and the ark and all of those things. You've sung songs about it from childhood and all of that. And so I've just picked a few verses right from sort of the, not quite the end of the story, the end of the flood, though, as they leave the ark. But between Cain and Abel and this, the breaking in of sin that we see in this kind of subtle, amazing way in the Cain and Abel story, and then the story as we get to it in the story of the flood and Noah and all of that, a lot has happened. We've had in the chapters 10 long generations. And when I say long, I mean long. These are people that live 900 and something years. So there's lots of things in the narrative that let us know that the world is, in that time is very different from our world. The one that is just a little kid when he dies is only 365 years old. And he doesn't actually die. God takes him from the earth. That's the famous Enoch. And so we have all of these things. We have the generations of Cain that have unfolded for seven generations, and then the generations of Seth, who gets born to Adam and Chava, Adam and Chava, and so on. And a lot of the people, the generations of Seth, several of them seem to be interesting, good people. We're at least told that Enoch walked with God and so forth. The oldest of them is Methuselah, who lives 969 years. He dies in the year of the flood. I don't know whether he died just before the flood came or whether he died in the flood. He drowned in the flood. He's the only one that comes sort of really close to living 1,000 years, but the flood cuts it off. And so, but the thing that I want to focus on here is not all of those details, but it is where the whole situation of humanity is described as having come. And I just have included on the second side of your sheet from Genesis 6, verses 5 and 6, right at the beginning of the description of the flood, the sort of the motivation. Yahweh saw that the human's evil was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their heart was only evil all day long. And Yahweh regretted, amazing statement, regretted that he had made the human on the earth. And it grieved him to his heart. Then a few verses later, now the earth was corrupted before God, and the earth was filled with violence. For all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, an end for all flesh is before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. What do you do about sin? Things have gotten so bad. How would you treat it? How would you deal with it? Well, part of the way in which these stories unfold is, is they're wanting us to ask that question of ourselves. And a lot of times we'd come down pretty hard if we were in a situation like that. These people deserve what they get. It seems perfectly reasonable. Wipe sin off the face of the earth. Start over with something new. Start over with Noah and his three sons. Noah lived to 500 years before he had his first child. Boy, that's a long time. And his sons were 100 years old at the time of the flood. But start new with Noah. He walks with God like Enoch did. And so it starts off, and we're told that that's the situation that God is dealing with as he sees this end. He regrets that he ever made the human being. But some comparison that I want to draw to your attention is like in chapter 2. You remember when God said, it's not good for the human to be alone. Did God have to go through the process of making all the animals in order to find out how to make an ally for the human being? I sort of doubt it. I don't think he had to do all that. He does that to make the animals, but also for us to see that all the possibilities had been tried. And really the only way for there to be a real ally for the human is for that ally to come from within the human self. And so he divides the human. And here, I don't think really that God thinks, well, I won't say that. I'll wait. Let's see what happens here. What I want to say is that the flood is an interim story. It's like the making of the animals. It's not the great narrative that's going to unfold. That great narrative of Abram and all the way down is going to be quite different. But here we see vividly one way that resonates with us, with our desire to deal with things forthrightly and start over in the flood. And so, as in this story, God decides to wipe everything out. And we get a lot of details about the ark and the flood and the birds that are sent out and so forth. An ark is not a boat. It's not a ship. Artists can never stop themselves from drawing it as a ship. It's the only other time in the Bible that the word ark occurs outside of this narrative is, anybody know? Probably not. The only other time it occurs, it's not the same word as the Ark of the Covenant, but it is the same word as the basket that they put Moses in when they put him in the Nile. That it's a teva. And that word is used for that basket that Moses is put in. This is a basket. This is a box. Noah doesn't navigate it. It doesn't have a rudder. He can't see out. It's there inside the ark. 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 50 feet high. We're told about the flood, the rain for 40 days and 40 nights, plus also the windows in the heavens, the windows of the vault of heaven. All the waters that are above the vault come flooding down. All the fountains of the great deep come gushing up. The waters that had been there from which the dry earth had risen. Everything comes there, and we see and we're even given a chronology so that you can kind of follow it. It's a year and a week after they go into the ark that they finally come out and so forth. But the thing that I wanted to call attention to that's always struck me in this story is that as God invites them all out of the ark, you have a clear echo of that verse back in chapter 6 that tells of the motivation, the situation that the flood was supposed to cure. And all of them come out, and Noah gets some of the clean animals and the birds and brings an offering. And God perceives this odor of the offering. And this is at the top of page 2, that's verse 21 of chapter 8 of Genesis. Yahweh perceived the soothing aroma, and Yahweh said in his heart, I'll never again curse the ground because of the human. The next line should be, since the problem solved, right? Since I've got a righteous man that we're starting over with and everything's going to be good. Shouldn't it be? Isn't that what one expects? But what God actually says there is, since the inclination of the human's heart is evil from youth, I'm not going to do this ever again because it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. Floods do not change human hearts. They don't turn human hearts from evil because the human heart has this sin crouching at the door that it empowers again and again. I'm going to have to stay with the earth and I'm going to have to stay with the people even though sin is part of who they are. And so there's going to be a story of wiping everything clean and starting over, much as it may feel satisfying in its forthright dealing with sin. It really doesn't do anything. It's going to take a lot longer story. I'm going to have to start with one person, Abram. We're going to have to go along through a long journey with that. And then Moses, David, and the prophets, and Israel, and exile, and the Messiah. And ultimately, I'm going to get back to the whole world. When Noah comes out of the ark, he makes a nice sacrifice. Yahweh smells the smell. But what's the very next story? Do you remember what the next story is? Noah becomes a, he becomes a farmer. Actually, a vintner. He starts a vineyard, and he makes some wine. And the human weakness comes up, and he gets drunk. And out of that getting drunk, there comes this event of sort of shame, and the meanness of Noah comes right out. He curses not his son, who had done something that seems to have dishonored his father, but his son's son. He curses his grandson, Canaan, for doing it. Noah's a wonderful guy and a mean guy, an awful guy, like Abraham and David and others along the way. God shows that the corruption, the sin, the human heart is the key element of all of this. This is something that Jesus says as well in the Sermon on the Mount and other so many other places. God chooses a long road rather than the fix. And God stays with us broken people. We're sinners. At any moment, God could plan a personal flood for me, for my sin. I bet he could for you too. Every one of us, in one way or another, deserves it. Though I think people treat me always unfairly, because I have a strong sensitivity about fairness toward myself. But God stays with me and with you and stays with us in our brokenness and helps us to see it and helps us to learn and picks us up when we fall and forgives and challenges and pulls us forward and promises. That's the thing that happens in all of this, that God makes promises. He makes it. They're coming out of the flood. He promises about the earth, and he promises about the seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and all of that. And he gives that rainbow in the sky. And all of it is so hopeful and so beautiful all around this broken, sinful human heart. Is that the way you would have told the story about sin if you had been writing this? Think about it. We like things clearer. The scriptures give us these parabolic narratives to challenge us to think deeply what it means to be with this kind of God who even follows Cain into exile. Let's bow together in prayer. Heavenly Father, Father, you know our brokenness and our weakness and our sin. We are so grateful that you take on our story, that you come for us. Yes, we can maybe even sometimes really see the sin right in front of us. But on our own, we just choose it over and over again, or we choose something that opens its power over us. Help us, Heavenly Father, that we can learn both our power to shape who we are and our future, to express who you've made us to be, and not be drawn into the power of anger and jealousy and all the other forms of desire and all of it that empower sin. But also help us, Father, to trust that you are God, that you are always there, that we may be in our own little exile from you, but you are always present, always loving, always protecting if we will receive your protection. Forgive us and keep us in your care. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen. Thank you so much for being patient with me this morning and for staying with this study along the way. Let's stand together as we receive some of the words from our opening call to worship. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's home is now among his people. He will live with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever." Amen. Greet one another and go forth to serve.
Thank you for listening to this week's message from the Manhattan Church of Christ. We are located at 48 East 80th Street in New York City. Adult and children's Bible classes are held every Sunday beginning at 9:30 a.m., followed by worship services at 10:30 a.m. For more information about the church and to hear previous podcasts, please visit our website at www.manhattanchurch.org.